Hello and welcome to Wednesday Night Bible Study. I'm Pastor Aaron, and today we are going to begin a new series, and it's going to be a little bit different than some of our previous series in that I am not teaching this live. So this is going to be pre-recorded, which has some benefits and some problems as well. But don't worry, you're still going to get my same bumbling because I'm doing this in one take, so I don't get to come back and scrub all my faults out. So you're welcome for that. And we are going to be jumping into the book of Jude today. Now, if you haven't studied Jude or you've done so superficially, it's really a neglected book of the Bible. And part of it is because it's weird. It makes some weird references. It kind of often is disruptive to the way that we view the scriptures or we view the world of the scriptures. I remember the first time I began to study Jude and go into a little bit more depth. I was expecting it to be, just a couple week filler series so that I could, hash out, my other schedule and get onto a meat and potatoes book. But then as I got into Jude, I kept going deeper and deeper into what Jude was saying, what he was referencing in the world that Jude inhabits. And it really kind of disrupted a lot of my thoughts and my views. But I have a special affinity for the things that are weird and different, the things that, don't necessarily fit with how I already view the scriptures. And so I like to dive into those, and I hope that you do too. Now, for a lot of people, as you get into an introduction to a book, some people find that that's like the most interesting part, going through all these, background details, and other people find it to be the most boring part. And I think the latter is probably a little bit more common. And so with that, we're just going to jump right into the text, and we're going to be dealing with these introductory matters as we hit them in the text. So for pretty much this week and next week, we're going to be going through the text and dealing with, all these introductory matters, like who the author was, why he was writing, who he was writing to, and all his opponents. But for this matter, we're just going to dive into Jude chapter, it's all chapter one. It's a short book. And if you don't know where it is, you go to the last book of the Bible, which is Revelation, and then you turn left until you get to the very beginning. And if you look, half a page over, Jude is probably there. In my Bible, it takes up about a half a page. If you have a little bit bigger font, it may take up a whole page, but it is short, but also it has a lot packed into it. So, if you would, we're in Jude, and we're going to start reading just the first two verses. Jude, a servant of Jesus Christ and a brother of James, to those who are called, beloved in God the Father, and kept for Jesus Christ, may mercy, peace, and love be multiplied to you. Now, the first thing that we get to is the author. The first word, which is typical of letters written in this time, in the Greco-Roman era, that you're going to start with the sender. And who's the sender? Well, it's Jude or Judas. Now, there are quite a few Judes in the Bible, or Judases, right? We have Judas Iscariot, of course, who, we probably know him the best. We also have a few other Judases, and we're trying to figure out, who is the one that's being referred to right here. Now, historically, people have thought that this is Jude, the brother of Jesus, or the half-brother of Jesus. So in Mark chapter 6, verse 3, we get this little account. So of people rejecting Jesus's ministry in his hometown, and they say, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him, right? So what we have here in Mark chapter 6 is there is a Jude or Judas, and who is a brother of James, not James the apostle, but James the brother of Jesus. And he is, this has historically been who people have identified with this book. Now, that hasn't been universal, right? John Calvin thought it was a different Jude, one of the apostles. So in Luke chapter 6, verse 16, we read about Judas
And your Bibles may say the son of, but really in the Greek it just says of James and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Now, we only have that reference in Luke. In Matthew and Mark, that Judas is Thaddeus. And so this character has been called Judas Thaddeus. And we may suspect that Matthew and Mark, with this character, you know, this person having two different names, either Judas or Thaddeus, wanting to distinguish between this character and Iscariot, who would later betray him, right? So they propose the Thaddeus name. But in Luke, who's a little bit more historically associated than the other Gospels, he really wants to dive into, well, perhaps his given name. And so he calls him Judas. And he is, and so John Calvin believed that that is the person who was the author of this. And for many Catholic believers, they view Judas, the brother of James and Jesus, and Judas Thaddeus as the same person. But there is a problem with that. We'll get into the problem with the Catholic view in a little bit. However, there's a problem with viewing this as the Jude that's being talked about, right? We talked about how it says Judas of James. Now, again, most of your Bibles may say the son of James, because that's the normal way of talking. You wouldn't say of James to refer to it being his brother. It's very much a stretch to assume or assert that. And so it's probably not that Jude, Judas Thaddeus. Also, Jude doesn't, unlike the other writings of the apostles, he doesn't identify himself as an apostle, right? Paul, you know, writes his letters, Paul an apostle, Peter an apostle, right? Jude does not do that. And why not? Well, probably like his brother James in the beginning of the book of James, he's not an apostle. He is what he says. He is the brother of James and a servant of Jesus Christ. Now today, what people often think of the book of Jude, and perhaps within the scholarly realm, they know that it is Jude, the brother of James, the half brother of Jesus, that is being here. But a lot of modern scholars say, well, it wasn't actually Jude; it was a pseudonymous work, right? It's somebody writing under the guise of Jude in order to carry his authority. Now, there's a few problems with this. The biggest is, well, if you were going to choose somebody from the early church to use their authority to write a letter, why would you use Jude? Right? He was not the most prominent. Why not use like one of the big guns? Use Peter or Paul or James, his brother. Why would you use somebody who is, well, doesn't necessarily, he's not the big household name. There's way better people to use. Why not use one of the apostles or somebody else? And so it seems a stretch to say that somebody who's wanting to use somebody else's name for their credibility is going to pick Jude out of the whole lot of people that they could choose. Now, why do people think it might be a pseudonymous work? Why not just go with the historical view? Well, the first thing they say is the Greek in the book of Jude is too good, right? This person knew how to use Greek. And, you know, if Jude, who is, you know, Jesus's brother, and he's a first century Palestinian Jew, there's very little way that he was going to be able to have this sort of familiarity with Greek as a language. And so they say, well, it can't actually be Jude. It has to be somebody else who's a little bit more worldly, a little bit more educated, a little bit more learned in the language of the world. Now, there's a big problem with this assertion, and it's because we are increasingly knowing that first century Palestine had a lot of Greek influence. And you know, you have Greek words inserted into the Jewish world. Like, we hear the word Sanhedrin. That's a Greek word. We look at Jesus's apostles. Two of them have Greek names, Andrew and Philip. And we even, it's becoming more common to view Jesus at times, maybe not all the time, but at times teaching in Greek, right? There's evidence throughout the Gospels that Jesus's words are spoken by somebody who, well, may actually know and speak and teach in Greek, that he has a familiarity with this, you know, the lingua franca of the day. So if you remember back from our study in the Sermon on the Mount, like way back, right to the beginning, Jesus opens with the Beatitudes. And if you remember back, you know, we have the first four, you know, Beatitudes, you know, those are the blessed statements, like blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek, blessed are the hungry, right? So 1 through 4, you know, emphasize just the, I guess, horizontal, or I'm sorry, the vertical disposition of the blessed life towards God, right? They are poor in spirit and they mourn. It is really emphasizing that vertical relationship that the person has between them and God in terms of being blessed. And then you have 5 through 8, which are more the horizontal view, right? Where it's how the disposition between the person and the world, right? We have the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, and those persecuted, right? Those are the blessed in terms of this horizontal relationship that the person has with the world. Now, one of the interesting things is when you go to the first four, when Jesus talks about who's blessed, he uses, well, a lot of alliteration. We don't see it in English, but he talks about the poor, those who mourn. He talks about the meek. And he talks about those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And each one of these words begins with, well, what we know as pi, or what's transliterated as, you know, the letter P. So poor is ptokoi. The mourned is penthuntes. The meek are praeus. And those who hunger are penantes, right? So Jesus is beginning everything with, you know, the letter, what we call pi, or the letter P, in this alliteration of these first four of this vertical movement. Now, what are the chances that Jesus will just, when you translate his words that were in Aramaic to Greek, that they would all just happen to begin with the same letter? It seems pretty, it doesn't seem very, well, it seems like a stretch. The chances seem small. And so a lot of scholars think, well, Jesus may have spoken in Greek. And so much that he was able to talk in Greek, that Jesus was so immersed in the lingua franca of the day that he could teach and do so using alliterations in that language. And in the second half, what we see is there's alliterations used within each of the, three out of the four horizontal beatitudes, right? Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. And we, you know, that one is pretty obvious that he's going to be using the same root word. But then he talks about blessed are the pure in heart, which is the katharoi te cardia, right? He's using that alliteration. And the last one, the blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness. So blessed are the diokemoi. Oh, I butchered that. And then the kaiosanes, right? Those who are persecuted. He's using this alliteration within each of these beatitudes. Now, again, what are the chances? What are the chances that as Jesus is teaching in Aramaic, that all his things end up having these plays on words and these alliterations that we see when they're translated into Greek? And it's probably not much. Jesus probably was able to speak in Greek and in Aramaic. And so why would Jude not be able to speak in Greek? Why would he not be able to be well-versed in the ways to be able to speak to the world around him? And if he spent years as a missionary and he was out there and his only way to spend time or to be able to teach people would be through Greek, why would he not have developed an ability to speak and speak well? So the idea that, well, it can't be Jude, this first century Palestinian Jew, because he speaks Greek too well, Well, it doesn't seem to hold much water. Now, the other objection to the historical view is this assertion that it seems just too late of a book, right? Jude talks about, you know, appealing to the faith, and, you know, in those first century, it doesn't necessarily seem that there is like this category, you know, the faith that they're going to have firm borders on. He talks about appealing to the prophets and the apostles as if it were something that age has already passed. Now, neither one of these really holds much water either. I mean, there's no evidence that when he talks about the faith, that he's talking about these, you know, strict codified borders that, you know, everyone is in, besides just, you know, very basic ideas about who Jesus was. And this idea that he's talking about the apostles and the prophets as if it were the previous age in verse 17 that people assert, well, his language mirrors that of the apostles. We see the very similar phrase in 2 Peter. We see Paul using very similar language when he talks about the words of the apostles. So the idea that he is in the next age is, well, it doesn't hold much water. So what we've come to the conclusion of, that the historical view is probably the best view. That this epistle, when Jude, the brother of James, is most likely Jesus's half-brother. And so Jude makes, and there's the what we would call the, you know, the skeptical view, the critical view, the arguments really just hold not a lot of water. Now, you may want to be asking, well, why doesn't he identify himself as the brother of Jesus? And that's a good question. Of course, that question, it applies to the book of James as well, right? James doesn't identify himself as the brother of Jesus. He identifies himself, like Jude, as a slave of Jesus, as a servant of Jesus. That it seems that for the half-brothers of Jesus, that Jesus was so elevated that they didn't want to use his name to bolster their authority, even if the early church did, right? James becomes an early church leader, after the resurrection. He is put in the list of the big church leaders, and even his name is often fronted at the very beginning. Right. And even when you look into the Catholic epistles of the Bibles, who's it start with? It starts with James. Right. James, Peter, John. Right. And a lot of people look at that as that's the church ordering this authoritative, James as this really authoritative figure as being the half brother of Jesus. But neither Jude nor James appeals to that at the beginning of their letter. They appeal to themselves as servants or slaves. And you may be wondering, the other thing is, well, how did Jude and James become church leaders? What happened in their life to move them from being people who, I would say, were not really down with Jesus' earthly ministry, to being people who were, well, involved in the church and leaders in the church? Now, if you can recall back into Mark chapter 3, Mark, he is, and I don't have the text here, but, you know, Mark describes this conflict between Jesus and the religious leaders. And, you know, they say, well, he cast out demons by the prince of demons. All right. And this news about Jesus is spreading, this slander about Jesus and his ministry is spreading. And the very next thing, what we hear is, his mother and brothers are coming to him. And what seems to be suggested and implied is that his mothers and his brothers, they hear these rumors and this news about what Jesus is doing, that he is casting out demons by the prince of demons, that he's doing these bizarre things, and it's accruing for them a reputation. We're living in an honor-shame culture where what somebody does, what the black sheep of the family does, reflects upon the family itself. And so Jesus's name, is being drug through the mud, right? Jesus is viewed as perhaps a heretic, perhaps in league with the devil himself, all these things. So what appears to happen is Jesus's family, his mother and his brothers, are coming to say, hey, can you chill out a little bit? Of course, Jesus responds, well, the ones who do the will of the Father are my mother and my sister and my brothers, right? He doesn't give them really this the time of day when they come up to see him. He doesn't listen to their rebuke, and we don't actually get to hear what their words are, but it seems to be implied by the Gospel of Mark. But either way, what we hear is that Jesus's brothers and his mother, they don't seem to be really enthusiastic about Jesus's ministry. But something happens, right? And we get into the book of Acts, and at the end of Acts 1:14, what we hear is, all these with one accord are devoting themselves to prayer together with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and his brothers, right? So what happens, right? There is this shift that from what was happening in Jesus's earthly ministry to now the brothers are gathering with prayer in prayer with the apostles, awaiting the pouring out of the Holy Spirit. What happens to take these people who were kind of seem to be embarrassed and ashamed of Jesus's ministry to leaders in the church? Well, what didn't happen was that Christianity became the new in vogue thing among their peers, right? Christianity didn't become, you know, a non-despised sect among many of the Jews at the time. What happened, well, what I think happened, what many think happened, is that they encountered their risen brother. They encountered the risen Jesus. That what did cause them shame to begin with was radically transformed when they encountered, well, that this person, that the God of Israel has raised him from the dead and vindicated him among in their eyes, right? This is what transformed their view of their brother. This is why they no longer, you know, call themselves the brother of Jesus. They call themselves the slave of Jesus. And so what we see is that this event really transformed, well, their view. And it's really hard to, one of the greatest apologetic defenses of Christianity is this transforming nature of those who asserted the resurrection. And we talk about Paul a lot, you know, this person who is the enemy of Jesus, who became, you know, hit the great apostle to the Gentiles. But seldom do we talk about James and Jude. Seldom do we talk about his brothers who seemed to be ashamed of his ministry and yet became one of the biggest leaders in the church, and James. And this other brother who no longer, he doesn't even call Jesus his brother, but his master. And he calls himself the slave to him. Right? For Jude, well, this event of the resurrection transformed his view of his brother. And so, and we see those first glimpses there, here. All right. Okay, so that's my appeal. Again, I don't know if these are the things that you find really interesting, this kind of this background historical things. I think a lot of people probably find this a little bit less interesting and a little bit more boring, but we are going to move on just a hair, and we're going to be talking about that next clause, right? So Jude, and the first thing he says is a servant. That's what the ESV says, but that can also be the slave of Jesus Christ. Now, when we think of slavery in America, of course, we go back to the nearest form that we see in the history books. We talk about, early American slavery, and that's kind of the picture in our mind. And as we read these words of Jude, and they're used through many, you know, James and Paul as well, that the apostles would call themselves slaves of Jesus. And it's not just servant, it is being a slave of Jesus. But slavery in the early world is going to be different than our world. So in our world, or in our near context, when we think of slavery, we have the free people who are up here, and then we have, you know, the slaves who are there. Like, the slaves are at the bottom of the social hierarchy, and, you know, these are separate things, and there's, you know, the slaves are at the bottom, free people are at the top, and, you know, that's the way it's structured. Now, in
early first century Roman world context, it was a little bit different. So you'd have slaves here and free people, you know, in this category.
Perhaps I should have made the slave bubble a bit bigger, but you know, it is what it is. But
so a slave could have more social status than free people, right? So if a slave to Caesar, you know, so Caesar's going to be at the top of the social hierarchy ladder of free people, but and his slave is going to be one of the most prominent, perhaps wealthy, and perhaps honored people in most places that he goes, if he's a faithful slave, right? Slaves would oftentimes, you know, slaves of very high-ranking people could be benefactors. They could have their own slaves. The slave would derive his honor and his social authority based upon two things. One, the honor of the family that he serves, and two, his faithfulness in his service. Right? The honor, the honor of the family that he serves and the faithfulness of his service to that family. That's what's going to bring the slave honor. And that's what's going to move a slave up the social ranks as they are able. And so what we see with the early church leaders is they had no problem calling themselves slaves to Jesus, right? Just as if you think that a slave to Caesar has social authority, well, what about the person that Caesar will call Lord? What about the one who is the Lord in Christ over all the earth? How much more honor is accrued to the person who is a slave to that person, Jesus? How much more honor when you faithfully serve Jesus over, you know, perhaps your earthly master, right? That's the accrual of honor for the early Christians, that they see this dynamic, this slave-master dynamic, but they see it, you know, themselves as slaves to Jesus, and that they are able to accrue magnanimous honor because Jesus is the magnanimous figure. He is the one who is over all things. He is the one who has placed all things in heaven and earth under his feet, right? And when we are his slave and his servant, well, we're talking about we have some serious honor that's accrued to us if we serve him faithfully, right? And so when Jesus or when Jude calls himself the slave of Jesus, that's what he's appealing to. He's appealing, like, that's his goal, to accumulate his honor. Now, this is very different than, well, what we often think in modern Christianity, right? We oftentimes have views of Christianity that would be, I would label, therapeuticism, right? That we serve Jesus, or we follow Jesus in order that we can, that he's going to make all of our life better without actually costing us anything, right? But that's not what Jude is putting forth, right? It is through our faithful obedience that we find honor, that we excel. Or often what we see in churches is what's called licentiousness, right? That I can act however I want. And, you know, well, I'm still Jesus's, you know, I'm still following Jesus. It doesn't matter if I am unfaithful to how he's called me to live. Well, what Jude is looking at and what the early church is looking at is that our honor is going to be directly related to our faithfulness to who, you know, what Jesus has called us to do. It's not going to be through throwing off the shackles of what we think that the scriptures are calling us, that are going to bind and make our life worse or do any of those things. Our honor is brought by our faithfulness to Jesus. All right, so we kind of dealt with the first verse, and we're going to be moving on to the second verse of Jude, the second half of the first verse. All right, so Jude, a servant of Jesus Christ, the brother of James, to those and who are called, beloved in God the Father, and kept for Jesus Christ. Right? And so who is Jude writing to? Now, what we see, it's often been labeled what's called a Catholic epistle, in that it's written to the larger Christian community, which is absolutely true. However,
and we're gonna find this out next week. But basically, Jude is dealing with very specific situations. But what we see in his letter is that his thrusts are to probably Jewish believers, right? These are the recipients of his letter. They are Jewish believers who are steeped in the Old Testament and even in extra biblical Jewish works that were available at the time. So if you've read through Jude before, you'll know that he just references all these different stories and events one after another, and it can be like overwhelming, especially if you don't necessarily know what's happening in all those events and stories that he's referencing. But he bangs them out at you, and he expects his hearers of this letter to be able to pick up what he's saying, to recall instantaneously all these events. And he describes them in three ways, right? They are,
it's beloved in God, kept either for or by Jesus, kept by Christ, and then they are called. Now, in your English Bible, called is fronted, and because the other ones are modifying that, these are going to be participles, but it's not that important. But in the Greek, called is the last description. I think that's going to be actually a somewhat important point. But what is he saying? He's describing the Christian identity. You know, what we can say is true about us. And if you notice one thing, perhaps the most important thing, is that all of these things, these are God's actions towards his people, right? That God is the one who calls, Christ is the one who keeps, and we are beloved in God, right? That at the core of his recipients, those who he's talking to, is this identity of who they are, not based upon what they've done or who they are on their best days or who they are on their worst days, but who God is to them, right? That is who they are. And that's very important. And they are people who are called, they are beloved, and they are kept. And he describes all these people. And so what it means to be, you know, we talk about they're beloved, which, I mean, is oftentimes, you know, as when we judge ourselves by who we are on our worst days, it is very tempting to wonder if we are truly beloved by God, right? I blew it. I messed up. I did X, Y, and Z. Does God still love me? And I think what Jude would say is absolutely. If you are called, then you are beloved. The other thing he emphasizes is to be kept by Christ. Again, there's a debate, is it kept by Christ or for Christ? And I tend to think that it's by Christ because it parallels being beloved in God. However, there is some debate there, and I'm not necessarily going to solve it here, but this is another part of who we are as God's people, is that we are kept by him, that Jesus' strong arm secures and saves his people, that as we face the world, that we are not doing so alone. We are not doing so even in our own strength. We are not doing so by our own power, but we are always and constantly kept by Christ. Does this mean that we can't lose our salvation? Does that mean that we can't, you know, ever reject the faith and find ourselves on the outside? No, it doesn't mean that. And Jude is going to make that clear later in his letter, where he appeals to them at the very end. And he says, "Keep yourselves in the love of God," right? And his whole letter is to, you know, the whole purpose of it is to make sure that people don't fall away and fall astray from the faith that God has called them to. And so, yes, Christ is keeping his people. That doesn't necessarily mean that we are, you know, that the Christian life is going down the lazy river on the inner tube and, you know, we're just happily floating along. It's we have confidence in Christ's keeping and sustaining power, that we are able to contend for the faith,
that we are able to keep ourselves in God's love, that we are able to walk faithfully before Him, right? We're living in a world where we see Christians renounce their faith. We see others going dormant. We see the others withering under the pressure of a world that says you must conform. And, well, there's good news for those who are called, for those who are faithful, that Christ will keep you. Christ will sustain you. Christ will keep you in the love of the Father. And that's good news. Right? But we have to understand that we have a received identity. We are recipients of God's covenant grace by being called, by being kept, and by being loved by Him. Now, as you go into verse 2, actually this time, and he gives his prayer to his people. And he says, may mercy, peace, and love be multiplied to you. Right? So Jude, he's writing to these people who are opposition, facing perhaps persecution, facing social rejection for being followers of, you know, Jews who are following Jesus and rejecting some of the larger, their larger world, and perhaps being disowned by their family. And his prayer for them is not that all these bad things are going to go away. It's not that they're going to be, you know, live the safe, comfortable life, but his prayer for them is that this received identity that they have, that they experience the fruit of what that is, right? They receive God's mercy. They receive God's peace. And they receive God's love. His prayer for them is that it is multiplied to them. Now, I wrote it in this way, and you can see like my indentation's kind of weird, but this is kind of how oftentimes you'll write to, and when you're presenting what biblical scholars are going to call a chiasm, which is basically, you know, there's parallel things there, and then they kind of spread out, and so like you have these parallel ideas that's happening, right? And this is why I think that called is presented at the very end of the sentence, is to highlight this chiastic structure of between their identity and his prayer for them, right? That as they are called, that they are called by God's mercy. Now, this word mercy is kind of like what the Greek word would use for the word hesed, right? It is God's faithful kindness to those that when they are in need, right? This, you know, peace is appealing. I mean, again, this is kind of like a very Jewish book, and so you kind of read these Greek words from within their Old Testament context. And so, you know, we have this word mercy, which probably alludes to the word hesed, and you have this peace, which is appealing to the word shalom, if you will, right? This they are being the wholeness of what God envisions for them. And it's not this absence of conflict. In fact, we know it's not the absence of conflict, because in the very next couple verses, he's going to talk about the purpose of this letter is for them to contend, for them to fight, for them to do, engage in this conflict with this threat that's happening. But he prays for peace for them, that they would receive the wholeness of God in their life, that as they undergo this challenge and this threat, that they would experience God's peace, God's wholeness for them. And of course, love, and we can see how love is going to be connected to them being beloved in a pretty obvious way. But what we see in Jude's prayer, and in perhaps in the prayers of, well, all the New Testament epistles, is that in the prayers, what we see is their hope for the people who are undergoing persecution, stress, trials, tribulations, all these things. It's never, God, can you just remove this as an obstacle? It's, God, can you let them understand who they are in you? Can they experience the reality of what is their true identity? That as they are called and beloved and kept by you, that they would experience your mercy, your peace, and your love in all things. And of course, you know, as a pastoral staff, that is our prayer for you always, right? Not and I mean, we lift up your concerns, we lift up your prayer requests, and actually, if you know, if you want to start writing your prayer requests right now in the comment section, so that as we go into prayer time, that we're able to jump right in, because there's not going to be as much of a delay as there has been in the past. But as we pray for you, our prayer is always not just that God relieves this temporary thing, but that you see the truth of God's presence and reality and grace and mercy and peace and joy and love in your life in the midst of your trials and tribulations. That's our prayer for you. And that's the prayer that was at the very front of Jude's mind as he sees this church. Now, thank you for staying with us. Again, keep writing in your prayer requests so that you can jump right into the prayer requests. And I also have a few other things for next week. If you would, read Jude, and I'd say even read it a couple times. It should take you about 5 minutes to read it. It is one of the shortest books of the whole Bible, and kind of get familiar with it. And also, because this is not going to be presented live, and this is going to be on a video recording, what I ask you to do is, if you have questions, and especially if you're reading ahead and you're getting into it and you're like, whoa, this is bizarre, or Aaron did not answer this question that I have at all, I want to just encourage you to put any of your questions right there in the comment section. I'll be able to address them next week before we dive into what's going on. But I would love to be able to, I mean, there is a lot of confusing things in the book of Jude. There's a lot of weird stuff, and there's a lot of things that doesn't even come across as weird. But when you dive into it, it kind of can rattle you a little bit. So if you have questions, please put them in the comment section. I will be checking in on them and reading them and making, you know, just finding out if there's things that are going unanswered. But I'd love to hear what you have to say. So again, thank you so much for joining in, and we're going to go into a time of prayer right now. Thank you, and God bless.